Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. This special episode of the Mind Moments podcast is focused on the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The spread of the novel virus has resulted in an upheaval of daily life, both inside and outside of the clinic. We are learning more every day about the risk for patients with neurological disorders, especially those who've received treatment with therapies that act on the immune system, and the significant adjustments required to keep clinical care running smoothly during this time. First, we're joined by Dr. Barry Singer, Director of the MS Center for Innovations in Care at Missouri Baptist Medical Center in St. Louis, who is actively making adjustments to his patients' treatment regimens to help reduce their risk in the face of the novel coronavirus.
My name is Dr. Barry Singer. I'm the director of the MS Center for Innovations in Care at Missouri Baptist Medical Center in St. Louis. Well, I think there's quite a bit of anxiety out there. I think there's anxiety on the behalf of providers and there's anxiety on the behalf of patients. So everyone's trying to figure out what the best way to manage this is. I think there's a lot of questions about which disease-modifying therapy people are on. Is it safe to continue? And what do they do to protect themselves from patients? What do they do to protect themselves from getting COVID-19?
Absolutely. And now, have you found that a lot of patients are, you know, highly concerned? I mean, I'm sure you've been fielding a lot of phone calls in the clinic.
Yeah, the calls have been calls, and we use a portal through Epic. So we're getting a lot of questions about what to do, and we've been trying to be as proactive as we can. My center, I have a website, mslivingwell.org, and so even over 2 weeks ago, I put a post about what our concerns are, which medications we're concerned about, how people can prevent themselves becoming infected, minimizing exposure. So addressing all that, trying to be proactive, but we have a lot of specific questions that are coming up.
What are some of those kind of precautions that you were, providing to your patients in terms of, you know, how they can best protect themselves, especially those who are on DMTs that do affect their immune system?
Yeah, so we're definitely recommending all the CDC guidelines about trying to stay 6 feet away, trying to isolate. Some people, I'm actually telling them a bunker mentality, you know, if you're vulnerable, particular older patients, just trying to stay out away from the public as much as possible, letting someone else go out to the store and get the, you know, get the groceries and try to really minimizing exposure. So I think that's one of the key advices. And then we're, definitely working on trying to figure out how we can start to have visits in the clinic, minimizing unnecessary visits, and in terms of, maybe converting over to telemedicine and figuring out ways to minimize exposure for patients.
So now in your clinic right now, I mean, is telemedicine something that you currently take advantage of in some way, shape, or form, or is it something that you're trying to ramp up in light of all this?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a ramp up process. I know my system, which is BJC, which covers approximately 15 hospitals over the region, is getting ready to ramp up. The problem is it hadn't been reimbursed in the United States for most care. And so I think we're behind the eight ball. Over the weekend, I was on Twitter and sent out a tweet to see if there was cases of other people with MS out there that had been exposed to COVID-19 and see how they were doing. And my colleagues, interestingly, in Italy and Spain and UK, they were already doing all virtual visits. And I think, unfortunately, I think the United States is a little behind in this process, and we don't really have well-established platforms that are universally used. So I think we're a little behind the eight ball, and we need to move quickly. And it's not just even in the MS world, but where a lot of our patients are immunosuppressed or have their immune systems compromised in some way, but we also have oncology patients out there, rheumatology patients out there. So we really need to try to minimize patients coming into the center if we can.
I know that there were some kind of emergency legislation at least discussed and signed in terms of expanding, you know, the ability to bill through CMS, you know, has, in terms of, like I said, kind of the reimbursement on your end in the clinic, I mean, what are some of those challenges that you face right now?
Yeah, so yeah, March 6th had passed that you could get reimbursed. And so this would be Medicare patients, which frankly is our most vulnerable patient population because these are people over 65 or people on disability for multiple sclerosis. So I think that could help. It's just a matter of getting systems to ramp up quickly is what we really need. So trying to get that implemented. But I see in my own healthcare system, I'm already getting emails and we're in conversations to get that ramped up quickly.
And have patients been receptive to that change?
Yes. I mean, I think they're concerned about their own health and, you know, I think that would be a great option. I mean, obviously, it's very hard to do a thorough neurologic examination remotely, but we don't want to expose patients to infections if we don't need to. And a lot depends on what region you're in. You know, in the United States, Missouri, so far, we have limited number of cases. We're under 10 cases last time I checked last night. And so, but some areas, you know, there's, you know, California, New York, but I think soon everywhere is going to be inundated with cases, and we really want to kind of minimize exposure if we can. Well, ideally, that's the way I like to see it going, that we could do these virtual visits and get compensated so that, you know, we keep our practices rolling.
Absolutely. So again, you mentioned that obviously the spread isn't as bad yet in Missouri, and hopefully it won't get much worse. But obviously, we are expecting to see an increase in the cases across the country still. So let's talk a little bit about the proactive actions you're taking with your patients right now. You know, again, addressing concerns about current medications that they're on. Have you been making adjustments to treatment regimens in light of all this?
Yeah, so we definitely have. So first of all, we have some patients on infusion therapies. For example, we have patients getting ocrelizumab, which depletes B cells, and we really don't know what the potential risk is for those patients. And they come in for infusions every 6 months. So we are basically, one of the things we're doing is looking at the age of the patient. So patients over 60 or 65, we're looking, do they really need to be dosed some immediately? So some patients, what we're doing is checking their B cells, and then we're going to recheck them in 2 months to see if they really, if their B cells have recovered or not, to see if we can delay the next infusion temporarily. And our older patients, maybe with more progressive disease and higher risk for COVID-19 serious complications. We're also trying to keep out of our infusion center other family members, so trying to minimize and try to separate the chairs as much as possible to minimize on that front. Patients on navalizumab, we're not quite as sure how vulnerable these patients are going to be, if there's going to be an increased risk or not. So we're proceeding with infusions for our navalizumab patients because there's a risk of rebound. And then we do have some alemtuzumab patients, so those patients have been advised, particularly the first few months after alemtuzumab exposure, to really avoid all direct contact. And then we have oral medications that we're making some adjustments. Actually, I've been switching a lot of my fingolimod patients to siponimod because fingolimod has, particularly my patients that are over 55, we're working on right now, fingolimod takes about 4 to 8 weeks for lymphocytes to come back if someone discontinues fingolimod. But with siponimod, it actually only takes 10 days for the lymphocytes to recover 90%. So in case someone gets infected, we can be able to discontinue the drug quickly. We have to watch out for rebound activity, but if someone got COVID-19, we'd be able to discontinue.
Clozapine is another oral MS medication that we're making adjustments. When you think about clozapine, there's a reduction in the white blood cell count, specifically lymphocytes, at 2 to 3 months after dosing. So patients that are relatively stable on their disease-modifying therapy, or older patients or patients with comorbidities such as respiratory problems, we may hold off on dosing clozapine at this point.
So we're not quite sure as much with the fumarate, such as dimethyl fumarate, what the risk is. We're more concerned about patients with lymphocyte counts that are less than 1.0. Teriflunomide, glatiramer acetate, and interferons are probably okay. We don't know for sure with teriflunomide, but I think patients are pretty safe on glatiramer. And frankly, interferon beta-1A is used by our lymphocytes to fight viruses as an antiviral compound. So patients are pretty safe on that front.
Now, I like I said, I follow you on Twitter, and I've seen that you've a lot of people in the MS community have been trying to connect with colleagues, obviously elsewhere in the U.S. and especially overseas, where you know we're a couple of days behind them in terms of this spread. You know, looking for MS patients who are currently impacted by the virus, and you know what the outcomes are. Have you you know, connected with anybody who's had any specific insight with someone with MS who's infected and how they're doing and what they're trying to kind of mitigate?
Yes, so I certainly did. So actually on Sunday, March 15th, I got up and I've been, you know, my own anxiety about how, because we care for so many patients, I wanted to know how things were going where more people were affected. And so I sent out a tweet about anybody out there, global colleagues, have seen patients with MS and COVID-19, and how are they doing? And fortunately, we got a lot of responses from around the world, particularly in Europe. And so far, actually, things have been a little more reassuring than I had anticipated. So we're seeing some patients on various disease-modifying therapies, including cladribine, alemtuzumab, ocrelizumab, fingolimod, that are actually doing quite well with relatively mild disease. And so some of these patients have just been at home. Some have been hospitalized. But I'm not hearing so far a lot of really, you know, bad situations. So clearly that could be coming as we get more information. I had talked to corresponded with Giancarlo Comi in Milan, and he they're getting up a database trying to send out a survey to get information about how the COVID-19 infected MS patients are doing over in Italy. Some reports sound like some patients are doing fairly well with MS. So there's some reassuring early signals, but obviously we're very early in this pandemic. But we want our patients to definitely take huge precautions and really trying to self-isolate and stay away from other patients that could be infected. If anybody wants to follow along, it is what you can do is go to hashtag MSCOVID19. So that's what we started last Sunday, March 15th. So hashtag MSCOVID19, and you can go on there and follow it. And we're putting up case reports globally up there so people can get a better sense of how patients are doing. I think it is a learning curve for all of us. We want to just be as proactive as we can. I think being proactive is going to minimize the impact on our patients' lives. And so having really people with MS really hunker down and really self-isolate. And I think you also have to think about your, as a provider, about your contact and exposure. I'm on a staycation this week since the vacation plans were canceled, and I've really been just trying to avoid a lot of contact. And I think that's very important as healthcare providers, is we want to kind of minimize our risk of exposure so we don't give this virus to our patients that are immunocompromised. I think the most important thing is to give our patients comfort in this time of crisis. And the best way we can do that is by giving them solid advice, following the CDC guidelines to protect themselves, and trying to minimize exposure to COVID-19. And really making adjustments in your practice, trying to get ahead of the curve in terms of being proactive with treatment decisions with your patients.
Our next guest is Dr. Nina Riggins, a headache specialist at the University of California in San Francisco, who, in response to the spread of COVID-19, has taken her practice online via telemedicine. Dr. Riggins offers her insights on the transition to telemedicine visits, as well as specific treatment considerations for patients with headache disorders.
Nina Riggins, and I'm headache specialist and neurologist at University of California, San Francisco. My first telemedicine experience started last week. In the current situation, I actually extremely appreciate ability to speak and give this interview. For me, it's also advocacy for my patients and my profession. I do feel that I would love to communicate this message that right now we all need to flatten the curve. And if someone sees that headache specialist working somewhere because of lack of personal protective equipment, without N95, without eye shield, and if patients scheduled for non-emergent appointments, that's probably would be time to intervene and strongly consider transition to telemedicine. I was very pleasantly surprised how much we can achieve during those appointments. I'm really thrilled to address issues meanwhile. One of the ways to do that would be instead, for example, procedures, we could start new modern medications. We switching some people with chronic migraine who cannot receive Botox due to safety concerns to CGRP antibodies. And it's great from the point of view that we do have 3 subcutaneous injections antibodies, ianalumab, galcanezumab, fremanezumab, which could be used at home. Mm-hmm. And there are wonderful videos online how to use them, and we're here to help to consult, and it goes very well. I would do it in appropriate cases. Mm-hmm. Another great ability we do have devices. And in discussion to multiple neurology and headache specialists around the country, we all start to use it a little bit more because it eliminates concern about medications interactions at this point. We can use them even if shortage in medication, person can have device. Mm-hmm. So we preparing for everything. And right now we do have 4 FDA approved devices. And one of them, it's called supraorbital transcutaneous neurostimulation. Mm-hmm. And it could be used for acute and preventive migraine treatment. And many patients with migraine really have benefit from that.
Sure.
And it could be very good addition. Our next device is single pulse magnetic stimulation. Also can be used for acute and preventive migraine treatment. And in addition to those, we have remote electrical neuromodulation, which actually very neat and can create good help with acute as needed treatment of migraine. Mm-hmm. And then another device which I offered more for both categories of people, we see migraine and cluster headache, which would be external vagal nerve stimulation.
Yeah, and again, I think, you know, in headache medicine, we're fortunate, right, that we have those other options. Have you had a lot of inquiries from your patients over the last maybe 2 to 3 weeks about different options, especially if they were, like you said, kind of coming into the office to receive Botox injections or something? Have you had a lot of inquiries?
We actually were initiators of conversation during last week. So last week we did have clinic open and we were trying to screen people and triage people and do everything possible to keep continue procedures in the safe way. But due to raise of concerns, we had to initiate this conversation. And it's very difficult for headache specialists. I love my patients. I want to see them. I want to tell them, please come over. And it was so tough to say, oh, we have to do it by telemedicine. We have to create these new ways. But I appreciate so much the overwhelmingly great response. And I feel that we're working together on that. I was doing telemedicine appointments all day today, and I will continue in the afternoon. And I just feel so grateful to the patients, extremely overwhelmingly wonderful responses. It feels like migraine warriors already, and we discussing how we can switch, how we can help. And I really felt this support of one other and that we're on that together. And very, very inspiring as always. And I think we're going to get through it together. I do appreciate also the fact that they are online resources. So it's so lucky that we have it. So this social distancing is physical distancing. We don't need to stay disconnected. I feel for myself, being part of wonderful women in neurology group, being basically essential. We can balance ideas. I saw there that Dr. Mia Minin, she already wrote with American Migraine Foundation very good suggestions, which I wanted to bring up. So 7 considerations for people living with migraine. And some of them I would recommend actually also for people living with cluster headache now. Advice would be have adequate supplies of your medicine. I spoke to multiple cluster patients and I asked, please make sure you have oxygen if that's what you use. You have galcanezumab ready if that's what you use for episodic cluster. Verapamil supply. If someone uses external vagal nerve stimulators, that could be very helpful nowadays. I did ask avoiding alcohol, avoiding any other triggers longer, even when you think that you're out of cluster bout, just to prevent triggering.
Right.
And it definitely should be concentrated effort to stick to a regular schedule for people with living with migraine headache to reduce migraine triggers. And we know that it is stressful time for many of people, and there are wonderful online resources. Don Bue's website have great relaxation videos and techniques there, and also resources with American Migraine Foundation. I really would recommend get together and consider Move Against Migraine group on Facebook, and actually excited that it will be free online migraine summit starting 18th of March. So everything to keep us together, to keep us connected, but in very safe way. Same thing with telemedicine. It does give doctors ability to evaluate important components of physical exam, to see if someone in distress or not distress, to help people. And I cannot be happy that I have this available to me.
Absolutely. No, I mean, you make so many good points. And it's like I said, I mean, I think everyone is really coming together to try, like I said, and provide these resources and make them available and easily accessible for everyone. So it's glad to see the community coming together and trying to lift everybody up, because it's certainly, you know, just a concerning time right now for everyone. I would say, you know, for your colleagues in the neurology space, in headache and outside of headache, you know, you seem to be well equipped for your telemedicine visits at UCSF. Do you have any advice, you know, or takeaways for any of your colleagues who may not be as used to using telemedicine in their practice, who may be forced to now?
That's exactly probably me. So I did my first telemedicine appointment last week.
Oh, it was your first one. Oh, wow.
It was my first one.
Oh, clearly.
Yes, and I was amazed. I always love to see my patients in clinic, and it was very not easy step, but necessary. Mm-hmm. I felt that it will give them ability to stay safe, and I can help them. And for that, I am willing to figure it out.
Well, I think that's a great attitude. And again, as someone new then to the space, I have to repeat yes. my question, right? As somebody new to the space, I mean, I don't think you can ask for a better attitude about changing the way that you practice. I'm sure it requires a lot, and it requires additional preparation on your side to serve your patients this way. So, you know, I think, like I said, you provide a great model for everybody else.
Thank you. Yes. What I do, I already review chart, as we always do, before appointment. And I start to think, what can I offer right now as alternative if someone had procedure? It's then we discuss together with patients, and very successful. All my appointments last week by telemedicine, and this week I felt by the end and conclusion of appointment that we have achievements. We have plan, and I feel that we're there for each other, and I tell everyone I'm here for you. We on that together, you can contact me. I'm checking my messages. Let me know how it goes. And we just regroup together for now. And as soon as this safety precaution lifted, I'll be more than happy to see everyone. But it goes very smoothly, which very, very good way to keep everyone safe. I wanted to mention one more thing about our staff and about our students.
Yes, absolutely.
And about everyone around. Our students actually offering extra help for any staff member or faculty member who, for example, they have kids at home out of school, and they need to attend to some management issue or some work issue, and students offering their help. It's all community coming together. Mm-hmm. And I always feel that it's time like that which brings us together, and we can get through it.
Thanks for listening to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. For more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com. And for the latest news on COVID-19, visit our sister site, contagionlive.com.